KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guest is Mathilde Rothschild. Mathilde is a 91-year-old lesbian activist and a retired social worker and psychotherapist.
After growing up in the South, Mathilde moved to California and lived in California for 46 years, mostly in San Francisco. Her last 12 years, she lived at Fountain Grove Lodge in Santa Rosa, and then she moved to and currently lives in North Carolina. Hello, Mathilde.
Hi, it's really good to be here.
We're so happy to have you here.
Yes, it feels familiar because you're such good friends on the outside.
Yes, you're a good friend of ours. Yes, indeed.
Exactly. Mathilde has lived a very rich and interesting life, and she's happy to share it with us. We can't wait to hear her stories. But first, here's news and events with our Outbeat member and engineer, Greg Moralia.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of March 2nd, 2025. In the conservative Muslim province of Aceh in Indonesia, two gay men have been sentenced by an Islamic Sharia court to public caning for being caught having gay sex. The couple, aged 24 and 18, were discovered by neighborhood vigilantes who broke into their rented room and discovered them naked together. The judge leading the trial said that the two college students were, quote, legally and convincingly proven to have gay sex and would be sentenced to receive 85 and 80 strokes, respectively. The judge added, quote, during the trial, it was proven that the defendants committed illicit acts, including kissing and having sex. As Muslims, the defendants should uphold Sharia law that prevails such acts. The judge explained that the men were outstanding students who were polite in court, cooperated with authorities, and had no prior convictions. He said, therefore, that they should not be subject to the maximum penalty of 100 lashes. Caning is meted out for a variety of morality offenses in the city, including gay sex, sex between unmarried people, gambling, alcohol consumption, women who wear tight-fitting clothes, and men who skip Friday prayers. This is the third caning sentence handed down for homosexuality since Ace was granted the right to impose Sharia law as part of a peace agreement with the national government back in 2006. According to Human Rights Watch, authorities in Ace publicly flogged two gay men 77 times each back in 2021 after a mob raided their apartment in November and caught the men having sex before turning them over to police. In 2017, police arrested 12 transgender women in Ace and shaved their heads, quote, to make them men. And here in the United States, according to a new poll by Gallup, 9.3% of adults identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or something other than heterosexual and cisgender. That represents an increase of more than 1 point since a 2023 survey, double the number from 2020, and up from 3.5% when Gallup first asked about sexual identity back in 2012. This year's survey included 14,000 respondents. 85.7% identified as being straight, 5.2% identified as bisexual, 2% as gay, 1.4% as lesbian, and 1.3% as transgender. Just under 1% used the terms pansexual, asexual, or queer, and 5% declined to answer the question. Among the 900 LGBTQ+ individuals interviewed in the poll, more than half, or 56%, identified as bisexual. 21% said they were gay, 15% lesbian, 14% transgender, and 6% said something else. Gallup pointed out that the figures don't add up to 100% because the survey allows respondents to report multiple LGBTQ+ identities. So the question is, what can we learn from this? In the 12 years that Gallup's been tracking LGBTQ+ identification, it's nearly tripled, as those becoming adults during that period have been far more likely than their elders to say that they are LGBT or Q. The recent increase, largely due to more adults in their late teens and 20s, particularly young women, saying that they're bisexual. But younger adults are more likely than older adults to identify as lesbian, gay, transgender, or other non-heterosexual orientations. The rate of LGBTQ plus identification is likely to continue to grow given the generational shift currently underway. And last week, Lambda Legal announced that it will represent 9 LGBTQ plus health and HIV organizations in a class action lawsuit against the Trump administration over its 3 executive orders targeting transgender people and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. The plaintiffs include organizations from here in the Bay Area, including the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. The plaintiffs filed the suit after the Trump administration sent out federal agencies notices to terminate any funding to organizations serving transgender people and entities that they deemed, quote, equity related, end quote. The agencies issued their notices after President Donald Trump signed orders for the termination of DEI programs and equity related grants, along with his declaration that the government does not recognize transgender people. The CEOs of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and San Francisco Community Health Center said that they have received stop work orders or termination notices for federal funds as a result of the president's order. So far, one federal district judge has issued a preliminary injunction against enforcement of these executive orders. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia.
So if you just joined us, we are talking with Mateo Rothschild, 91-year-old lesbian activist. And Mateo, we want to thank you so much for giving us a little bit of your time.
Thank you so much. So I want to say hello to the listeners, and I'm really glad you're here. And to see my old friends, Sheridan and Diana, whom I've known for quite a while in Santa Rosa.
So in our introduction, we talked about that you're a lesbian activist. Mm-hmm. You're a retired social worker and psychotherapist. You're 91 years old. You've lived a life. And we are so honored to have you on our show and get a little snippet in 50 minutes about you and your life and your adventures.
And I know there are lots and lots of wonderful stories that you can tell us, but we can start from your activism in San Francisco or wherever you started. Want to start?
I started being an activist when I was 8 years old.
What? How did that happen?
Yes, I've always wanted to help people. And during the Second World War, I started collecting cans for the cause. You know, cans were metal. They wanted metal. I don't know if they ever used them, but that was my first big volunteer job. And I've continued being a volunteer many places and on boards all the rest of my life until the last few, when it was harder to get out, even though I did volunteer at Fountain Grove Lodge where I lived. What I liked about activism was whatever was the important issue at that day, like growing a gay community or gay rights or civil rights, or during the war to help out, or whatever the issues were, that's what I was mostly interested in and put my time. And my volunteer work has really been more important to me than the money I earned as a therapist and social worker.
That's huge. That's a very powerful statement, Mateo.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that? Like, why do you find that more important?
It feels like this is my mission in a way in life. My passion is doing things that I want to do to help people, even though my work also involved helping people, obviously, as a social worker. But it's different when you're doing it from something in your heart. And I did love my work, but it was so important to me to be able to get out in the community and work with community people. So I've carried that with me all along.
I'm thinking about, Mateo, when you said at 8 years old, What made you think of like, okay, I'm going to go and collect cans? Did your family or you just had?
Yes, my family's always been volunteers. Yes, they all were. And I'm the baby in the family, so they were much older and they were already doing all those big things. you know, by the time I was in high school, my brothers were on boards and whatever, things like that. So I had a picture in front of me, and my sister and my mother did incredible work in this town we lived in, which was relatively small, about 40,000 when I was young, but later was, you know, over 100,000 people and so forth. But yes, I had lessons all around me of people that like to help other people.
That's beautiful modeling for a young child.
Mm-hmm. And when I got older, I not only wanted to volunteer, I wanted to develop new organizations that would help people further. And did quite a bit of that.
In what way did you want to help people?
Yes. Well, for example, when my children were young, there was no lunch program at school. So we developed lunch programs. When ERA came around, which still hasn't passed, sadly enough, I wanted to organize groups, support groups for women and teachers and stuff, so we could help get that passed. It was a lot of work. I worked tirelessly on the first laws and houses for domestic violence in New Jersey, when I lived in New Jersey. In New York, while I was a student, I couldn't volunteer too much. But when I moved to San Francisco, it was a wide open field there of developing things, because so little in the 80s, so little had been developed yet. It was just the beginning of a lot of big, wonderful organizations. And it was a fabulous life. I mean, on Sundays, we could order brunch delivered by topless women, lesbians. And on weekends, we could go to numerous dances all over, in school gyms, in fabulous hotels, anywhere. I can't remember the year it started, but there was an organization called BACW, Bay Area Career Women, which had over 1,000 career women, women working in all fields. You didn't have to be in industry or something, but a lot of people were beginning to work with computers. And also, you could be a teacher or you could be an artist, as long as you were working. And it was the first in the country, even though quickly other things started like that.
What was the year of BACW? Do you know? Do you remember?
I can't remember the year it started, but the late 80s, mm-hmm. sometime, mm-hmm. like 88 or something. It was already in existence in 1990. It had been going several years. And they had fabulous dances and networking for women to meet each other and help get jobs. It was great networking, and a lot of things that women hadn't had an advantage of before, particularly as lesbians. It was so exciting. It was really exciting. I will mention you, Nicole, is the founding mother, you know, of the ACW. But my aim in San Francisco, before I even got there, I asked for names of people who were interested in any way with aging or older or senior lesbians. And there was nothing except private meetings. And so I immediately called around, and I found out two women had tried to start a group and they didn't really want to do it. And one wasn't qualified to be a leader. So when I got there in August and September, I stepped into this group and became the leader of that group for about 8 years. It was volunteer work, but I did get hours from it to help me get my license in California. And it was called Operation Concern in those days, and was funded by the city as a gay and lesbian mental health center. And from that little group and lots of community inquiries and support and speaking around, being invited to speak around. The next step was to really start an organization for older lesbians. We didn't know where they were. They were all mostly hidden. We didn't know how old they were. But we started, and Operation Concern became a very, very large support group. It had all kind of support groups, lunches, art classes, every kind of class you can think of, hikes, trips, everything that a community organization would have. And too bad that finally, one of the executive directors went too far with their success and it went bankrupt. But parallel to that, I was also working with a senior housing organization. Senior housing doesn't exist by itself. It has to also have community supports and groups and things. So when that organization went bankrupt, the two joined together with what was left of it, joined Open House, which is where I was on the founding board. And my life was there. I spent so many hours a week.
What is Open House?
Open House is a community organization that has now built a beautiful building with about 88 apartments for gays and lesbians and bisexual transgenders and the whole works. And it's near Castro Street. It's on Laguna. And it took so many, many years, almost 20 years, to get the buildings built because of all the politics in San Francisco and the thousands of meetings I had to go to convince people or be there to show support, et cetera, et cetera.
Mateo, that's great. I mean, admirable work that you did. Uh-huh. Seniors, but you, when you got to California, you're in your 50s, right? So what made you think about doing this big, important work with seniors?
Well, I really wondered what would happen to me if I got any older. And in the lesbian community, 50 was considered old then. I don't know who remembers, but there was an organization called Older Lesbians in Berkeley, and the age of older was 30.
Mm.
And it had been one of the major organizations for, quote, older lesbians. But at 50, there weren't too many people known and nothing around for us, nothing. So that's how I got interested. I had been interested back east, but I wasn't in a real community like San Francisco. So this was a big new part of my life, even though I had many exciting things happen before that. You know, when I was living in New York, and I also lived in Europe four different years, I think. And I got married to a gay man.
Oh my goodness. Let's stop right there and let's talk about that for a minute.
Yes.
Because that's just not a throwaway little thing. That's a huge thing.
Uh-huh.
So talk about that.
Yes.
Talk about this man and what happened and how you came to marry each other when you were both gay.
He was gay, and I had been attracted to women in high school and still had a great attraction, but I wasn't practicing it. And I was around fairly many lesbians in New York, but we were both in the doctoral programs at Columbia. And it was very clear to us that there were no jobs available in professors' lives if you were gay. There was no school that was going to hire us or anything. So we didn't really discuss it a lot because we fell in love. But we knew underneath that we needed to have another life. And fortunately, we didn't have to talk about it a lot because love took over. And We had two children. We were married more than 20 years, and we had two children. And right now I'm living with my daughter, who is 60 years old. So I've had a long life as a mother and parent, and my children having two gay parents, which was very hard for them, very, very hard back then. Back then, it wouldn't be today, but it really was hard.
So give us the decade when you say back then.
Oh, well, I started dating Harold in 1958. So it was the 50s in New York. And we got married in 1960, and it was still, gay life was very scary in New York. There was a few gay bars for women, and they were pretty seedy, and they were investigated by the police very often. It was scary to go to them. There was some before Stonewall. This is long before Stonewall. So New York was exciting. We knew exciting gay people. We'd be invited to Halloween parties and get rent costumes from a costume place and get on the subway in our Renaissance costumes and go down to Brooklyn to a gay party. It was really fun.
So you and Harold, you were, I guess, hiding behind heterosexuality, giving this false, you were in love with each other, but you used each other to get through so that you could, Mathilde, you could meet women and Harold could meet men. Is that right?
But we were pretty much a monogamous couple for at least 20 years.
Oh.
Almost 20 years. We didn't carry it out. We were very devoted. We had a lot of gay friends. In fact, our holidays like Thanksgiving and parts of Christmas and all, we were with mostly gay friends we had. And we knew other people like us who had gotten married without being in love and were living in apartments. Two couples we knew were living together, supposedly heterosexual couples, but they were not that.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
But when I got to San Francisco, I had this great shock. I met a woman who was in one of my support groups, and she and her husband were both gay, and they had children about the ages of my children, and they had a duplex in the Village. I mean, not in the Village, in San Francisco, in a really nice area. So the men went one side and the women went the other side, and the children just went back and forth. Today, that sounds so simple, but it was not simple then. They were the only people I knew like that. And then I met a couple more after I met them. But it was a different era. It was totally different and still not safe to be out at work, still not safe to do a lot of things we would do today and not worry about it at all.
And being in California was easier than back east.
San Francisco was just different. It was so different, yes. So I've loved my life, no matter where I lived, whether it was in New York or Paris or Munich or wherever we were living, London, all over. I love my life. And part of it is that wherever we lived or wherever I've lived, I've always had wonderful friends who made life so, so valuable and special. And I still am in touch with friends who are still alive who went to nursery school or preschool with me, and they're my age. They're 91 or 92.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Long time connections.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I appreciate about you, Mathilde, because you used to tell us stories all the time about all your friends that you have, that you still have from long, long time ago.
Yes. And I feel so fortunate to have all these friends. It's a major, major part of my life. I don't know what I would do without friends. However, I moved to North Carolina during 2024, and I don't have any friends here, and it's very isolating. And as soon as I feel better, I've got to get out there and meet some people or do something drastic. because living without friends just doesn't feel like me.
Uh-huh.
How did you get to North Carolina?
Yes. Well, you already said my age, that I'm 91. And this happens to a lot of people when they're not as healthy as they were at 80. I'm not sure longevity is all what it's cracked up to be, even though I know Sheridan has a wonderful mother who's very healthy. And she's a star example of what it may be like to live into the 90s. I haven't exactly felt that way. I have had a lot of health problems, not internal problems, but more like structural problems of my legs and hips and knees and everything giving out. So I felt I needed to be near my family. I haven't lived near any family at all since college, really, since I went to college. I was so glad to be free of being around a lot of family, and I haven't done it since. But then the time came when friends supported my move, and my daughter and her husband, they were very anxious for me to move here and had been asking me for about a year if I would do that. And so I decided to come here. I wasn't sure that I would stay forever, but my health declined more and I could not travel. So I decided this is going to be my home. It seems very, very strange to me not to have another home that is my own home, because since college, I've had my own home somewhere, but I don't know. I'm in someone else's home. For the most part, it's really wonderful. And some of the problems are because the move has been so emotionally shaking to me that I have to adjust. And part of it's that there's no perfect way to live with anybody or no perfect place to live. I talked to friends at and Grove Lodge, where I lived 12 years, and they're complaining every day about all the problems there. And they can't do anything about it. At least the problems I have here, I can do something about just by talking to my daughter and her husband. But it's often not so easy, and I have grandkids here, and I have great-grandkids here. And I love being with the little kids. It's just a very, very different life.
That sounds beautiful. It does. It's
what I dream about are those wonderful first years in San Francisco that were so open to anything. So many. Every weekend, you could pick what kind of something you wanted to go to for a weekend. The Friends gave weekends. The Buddhists gave weekends. Therapists were giving weekends for people that wanted monogamy or non-monogamy or sex or whatever. There were so many things you could choose from every weekend, and I don't think all that exists anymore, but it was wild and fun and crazy, and we had a really good time. I was with some women during that period, but I didn't find my great love until 2001.
We want to connect with that, yes, later on.
Yes, we do. It's
that's beautiful.
Time for a music break right now, and then we're going to come back and talk about your great love.
All right.
Because it's beautiful.
I want the listeners to know that I picked the song and that it's really old-fashioned music, but the words are beautiful, and that I hope the listeners will listen to the words.
What's the name of the song and who's singing it?
The song is called Here's to Life with Shirley Horn.
All right, everyone. We are going to be listening to Here's to Life, sung by Shirley Horn, one of Mateel's most favorite songs. And she's inviting you to really listen to the lyrics. And we will see you on the other side.
No complaints and no regrets, I still believe in chasing dreams and placing bets. But I have learned that all you give is all you get. So give it all you've got. I had my share. I drank my fill, and even though I'm satisfied, I'm hungry still to see what's down another road beyond a hill. And do it all again. So here's to life. And every joy it brings. So here's to life. To dreamers and their dreams. Funny how the time just flies. Our love can go from warm hellos to sad goodbyes, and leave you with the memories you've memorized to keep your winters warm. For there's no yes in yesterday, and who knows what tomorrow brings or takes away. As long as I'm still in the game, I want to play for laughs, for life, for love. So here's to life, and every joy it brings. Here's to life, for dreamers and their dreams. May all your storms be weathered, and all that's good get better. Here's to life. Here's to love. Here's to you.
Thank you.
So that was Shirley Horn singing Here's to Life. And what a gorgeous song, Mateel. Mm-hmm. Mateel, are there any words that stick out for you from that song that you love so dearly?
Well, at the end, here's to life, here's to love, here's to you.
Oh,
isn't that fabulous?
That is fabulous.
The way she sings it.
Yeah.
I can't sing it.
I've never heard that song before, and it is truly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is nice and slow, and it kind of sets the tone, doesn't it, for a nice... Mm-hmm. Mm. A nice, I don't know, a nice evening or something.
Yes.
So Mateel, I know we told the listeners that we would talk about you and your love of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you guys have to wait a little longer. But before that, we want you to talk about a little bit about being abroad in Paris and Europe and places, London. What took you there?
Well, if you're an academia and you have a PhD in a certain field, you're expected to write and do research or you'll never get anywhere. So that's what we were doing in Europe. And we usually could get some small grants to help pay for it. And Europe was cheaper than America, so it would work. Even though we were staying in places, well, we would eventually get a little apartment that was cheap or something. But, you know, we would also stay in places that were $10 a night. That book that came out, Europe on $10 a day. And, you know, we met fabulous people. But through the research, we met a lot of famous people who were... had lived through the war and who were very interesting examples to us of what our lives were like at that time. And three wonderful Jewish French women who were about 10 years older than me, they adopted me as their little sister. And I was friends of theirs for 47 years before they died. And they survived the war by hiding in different houses all over Paris and were very marked by the whole war. In truth, they lost their parents and most people they knew. But they were the most wonderful, wonderful women. And they taught me so much about French history and culture and taking me to castles and without a guide telling me everything. I mean, they were well versed in everything. I was so lucky. And four times I went to the Alps and met them, and we hiked in the Alps, not climbing mountains. You take the lift going up, and then you hike across the mountains, and then you come down somewhere in a different town you've never seen in your life, and then there are buses that take you back to wherever you want to go. Not just for me, they're public buses in these little bitty alpine towns. And I love that. I am always so happy in the Alps. Something about the air there, it's so exquisite. And the hiking was so beautiful. Hiking through little valleys and little towns. I mean, it's just wonderful. And then being up in the mountains, looking down at these little bitty villages. So wonderful.
Mateel, didn't you tell us once that you knew Rita Mae Brown?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I did. I knew her very well for a short period. She had already published Ruby Fruit Jungle when I knew her, so she was famous. And she was with a beautiful woman named Nancy Cunningham, and they lived near me in New Jersey. Why they moved to New Jersey, I don't remember, but they were there. And I guess I just got to know her by going to hear one of her talks or something. I'm not sure how I originally became a friend, but they used to come over pretty often. My son said, "Oh my, she's this feminist who hates little boys." But she actually grew to love Chris a lot. She moved away to be with one of the first lesbian congresswomen in Massachusetts, whose name I can't remember right now. And they broke up. She and Nancy broke up because she found a lover in Massachusetts. But after that, we weren't you know, we were no longer friends for a lot of different reasons that I don't want to go into. But yes, we were friends, and she came over a lot. She and Nancy came over a lot. But then I remained friends with Nancy, and in one of my big projects I took on was Nancy and myself and Nancy and another woman who was a social worker and a professor at Rutgers. We tried to start a women's college during the early feminist period. It was so exciting, only we didn't know what we were doing. We had never tried to do anything like that. But actually, we did get it off the ground, and we found a community college near Trenton that would give our students credit if they took an exam monitored or written by a professor there. And after a few years, we had two courses going. One was about the environment, and the other one was about gay rights or gay life. And one was about women's rights and stuff. And we had a very few students, like 15 or something. But you have to start somewhere. And there had been in New York already a women's college on the Upper East Side that some women started in a kind of empty building or something, and that they rented at night. And it was very successful. And that gave us the impetus to keep going and to try to do it. But, you know, we all had other lives and other interests. And so after a few years of that, we let it go. It was so much work, you know, and travel around the state.
There's so much to know about you, Mateel. We didn't know about that part. Wow.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Yeah. I've started, you know, I changed from being just a volunteer to a person that liked to develop things. And this is really big. But I didn't know enough about grant writing, particularly government grants. I should have taken a course in it, or if we had the media today, I could easily have found out. But I didn't know. I had written grants for, organizations I worked for, helped them write grants, like family service and stuff like that. But the government's a whole different thing. And I didn't understand. I didn't really understand it well enough that we could really get the money. There were only three of us working, you know, and then we had a few people volunteer. But it was very exciting to even try it. You know, it was exciting. And the reason we felt it was necessary was the town of Princeton is different from the university. But the town of Princeton, by being in so close with the university, had collected a list of women with PhDs who were out of work. And I've forgotten who knew about that, but we got the list and we talked to some of the women, and they said anything that we could do to help women get jobs. So if we started a university, we could hire women who could do those jobs. And that was how it started.
Wow, Mateel, you've done so much, and it's really wonderful. And I'm just thinking about you being a researcher. You, uh-huh. You're like a researcher through and through. You always got your hands in something. Uh-huh. And if you don't know about it, you always trying to find a way to learn about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's our relationship mm-hmm. over the last mm-hmm. 10 years. Well, how long? Eight, mm-hmm. 10 years?
It's really part of my DNA or something yeah. that I like to research things and find out about them and how they work. And on any kind of subject, doesn't matter what it is, you know, I just find it interesting. And now it's so much easier to do research than it used to be.
In the medical field? Every time we have a yes. problem, you just get on the computer and yes. you figure it out. It's amazing. And you're so knowledgeable yeah. about the medical field, too, you know?
Yeah, well, I did work in the medical field for a long, 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 long time. Yes. But I'm very proud of my work that I did, even though I didn't make much money from it. I'm very proud of it. And I was never seeking a lot of recognition. And I got recognition, little bits of here and there. But the things that are most dear to me is that Open House every year, you know, has these fundraisers where they recognize people who've done a lot. And I got a big award from them for my contributions to the growth of that, which I'm a founder. also Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, Department of Public Health, had a very special program recognizing seniors who had helped women, particularly seniors, with projects, and not for money. If that was the field you worked in for money, you didn't get this honor. You got the honor if you were doing it for volunteer work. And that program went on for about 10 years, but I was in one of the earlier groups of it, I think 2004 or something like that. It was from Berkeley and the Wellness Foundation or something in the state. And it wasn't the kind of thing you go and you get the award and you come home, that's it. They followed me and for every year and gave me money to give to organizations that I was involved with for all those years that they were existing, like a $500 a year, $1,000. It was more, seemed more then. And it formed like a group of older people who were working with older people. From that, I got a lot of other recognition as being a person involved with helping seniors in the Bay Area, in California. So it was very, very valuable to me, and more than most things. And, you know, nobody really cares about those awards for me or anything, you know, or ask about them. And I'm not attached to them. You win my apartment many times. You never saw them sitting around. But it meant a lot to me. I'm very proud of the fact that I've really devoted myself since a move since 79 to helping seniors in the Bay Area. And it feels good. You know, it feels good to do things which are really from your heart and you really want to do it. I don't know how I did it, having three jobs and being on these boards and going to all these meetings. I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that part of your life with us. We do want to move on and talk to you a little bit about what we told listeners that they would be privy to after the break, which is your significant other, how you met and what this person's name was. And
yes, this wonderful, wonderful woman named Joni Zimmerman. I met in 1990 when she very first moved to the city, and we were in similar friendship groups, but we never, never thought about getting together. And she was a new, beautiful person in the community, and everybody wanted to date her. So she had no problem finding partners. I was single most of those years, but I wasn't interested in her. She always had a partner. But come along many years later, and I was almost 70 years old, and she was 2 years younger. And then she was single. And my friend said, "You've got to get to know Joni. She's really wonderful. I know you know her. You've been around her for 10 years, but you don't know her." I said, "Oh, I don't even like her that much, so forget it." And we were thrown together so many times. I mean, there were TGIFs every Friday. There were still people going and getting, you go to those stores and get a disc for a movie. What was that called? Those stores. There were people doing that and then taking the disc home and having over a bunch of lesbians to watch a movie. So every time I went, she was there. Then there would be things like an art show of some special interest, and there would be Joni. So I wasn't dating her. I was just around her all the time. And she was single then. So my friend said, "You got to get to know her, do something with her, invite her over or something." Well, I didn't. They decided they would do it for me. They invited us to dinner and they had us here and there. And then they would think of things like, "Oh, we got to go see this show over in the Presidio. So why don't you bring Joni over there?" It was so arranged. It was arranged map making, yes. So finally, on St. Pat's Day in 2001, she invited me to dinner at her little apartment. And to me, that said a vote of confidence. So then I invited her to go out to a restaurant or something. And we started seeing each other kind of regularly for a month or so. And then it developed into a relationship, only I thought it was the wrong one. I said, we don't have anything in common. We're falling in love, and you don't like to hike. You don't like to walk. You don't like to travel. You don't like all the things that I loved. And so I said, oh, maybe we should break up. Oh, I don't know how we're going to do this. We're so different. So we had planned to go to see my son down near Santa Cruz for Easter. And we went down there and we were having a great time. And I went in the kitchen to help him do dishes or something. And I said, well, what do you think of Joni? And he said, oh, she's so wonderful. She's great. She's so cute and she's a lot of fun. And I said, well, I think we won't see her anymore because I already told her last night I want to break up. And he said, Mom, are you crazy? So we were together 20 years. And it was a very different kind of relationship. It really was. I don't think I would have done it at 40, but at 70, it seemed like just the right thing. And she was so outgoing and so loving people and so loving as a person. I can't imagine my life without her in those years. And she died in July of 2021. And I haven't gotten over it. I'll probably never get over it. And she was a major love of my life. You know, I think we're lucky if we have one. And I feel like I had two because I really loved my husband, Harold, and the father of my two fabulous children. And Joni also, I loved her so much. She liked you too. She loved you guys. She loved you so much. And she was a very unique person, you know, really unique. And I'll always miss her, always. And I'd like to say to people who are getting older that when my health started declining, after she died, and I decided when I came here in September and then I got worse, that I should stay here. I would like to say that many people do that. And I understand that it's a very hard adjustment for people in their 80s or 90s who move to be with family. And we are taken out of our lesbian and gay and transgender communities and everything. But you know, sometimes in life we have to do those things. And it's really important that we get care and love in our later years. Somehow we need that, you know. And it is available when you live in beautiful, beautiful places like Fountain Grove Lodge, which is dedicated to the gay community and has many. The population there is mostly gay, but it changes all the time. It changes. So you might have friends who love you there 1 month and then they move out or they go somewhere else. So it's not like having family that is devoted to you. It's so important. If you're one of those people who are listening and you're older, spread the word to other people. That if you do have to move and get taken care of, it's better than being all alone in your late years. It's really important.
Thank you so much for those words of wisdom, Mateel. Very, very important. Mm-hmm. And we want to thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mateel. And yeah, we miss you a lot.
So, yeah, I miss you too.
And the relationship that we grew and that we've grown over the years, mm-hmm. with you and Joni. I just really appreciate it, your love and your attention.
Yes, it's been really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yes, and your program's gone on for how many years now?
Oh, over 20.
Over 20 years. So you have so many voices on there saying different things.
Yeah.
I guess my one thing would be about trying to be an activist in your life if you're younger and when you're older. To plan for it, to try to plan for your old age so that you know you're going to be taken care of. Even if you have a partner, you need to know you have some plans of how you can live and have enough money to live and how you can get care. I have two couples in my life right now where both people are really, really, really sick. And they've never planned. And the stories are so sad, I just can't even talk about them. So I'm asking every one of you, if you're older, to plan. Start planning in your 70s or your 60s. I moved out of San Francisco to live in Fountain Grove Lodge, which I was thrilled that it was gay-oriented. The mission is to have a gay place. It was my dream come true to live there, and I thought I would stay there forever, but sometimes you have to even give up those dreams. So please plan ahead, people. Plan, plan, plan.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Mateel.
Really?
You've made our lives much richer, not only tonight, but in our lives generally, Diana and my life. Thank you so much.
Mateel, I want to just say to you, happy Women's History Month.
Oh, all right. Well, that's good to know.
And it's time to say goodbye to everybody. We want you to remember that just like Mateel, you too can be living proof that through being visible and vibrant and perseverant and finding your niche, you can make this world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then, good night.
I step out of the
For Outbeat Radio on KRCV-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCV-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.